The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome, everybody, back to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle. If you're hearing my voice right now, then that means you are listening to the culmination of a very exciting Part 2 episode, and I'm really excited to get into it. I am Detective Shea Butter.
And I am Aaron.
All right, so tell us what you got in store for us, Aaron. What are we doing?
Well, before we begin today, let's go ahead and acknowledge our sources. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram, US Today, Washington Post, Albuquerque Journal, and the New York Times. Finally, we use the Emmy-nominated Showtime documentary Disgraced, which we will talk more about specifically at the end of this episode. This is part two of the story of Patrick Dennehy and the Baylor Bears, so be sure you've already listened to part one. Last episode, we learned about Patrick Dennehy, the 21-year-old who had just transferred to Baylor University to play on the men's basketball team. In June of 2003, Patrick suddenly went missing amidst an array of accusations of threats and thefts by another Baylor player. However, it was a third Baylor player, Patrick's close friend Carlton Dotson, who ended up confessing to and was arrested for killing Patrick in self-defense while the two were practicing shooting their guns. At least that was Carlton's story. 6 weeks after he went missing, Patrick's body was discovered in a gravel ditch a few miles from the Baylor campus. Patrick's remains were taken to the Southwestern Institute for Forensic Sciences in Dallas for autopsy. He had been shot twice in the head. The first bullet had entered his head about 1.5 inches behind his right ear, exiting his upper left forehead. The second bullet entered 0.5 inch above his right ear and exited behind his left ear. If we remember, Carlton's statements to law enforcement described how he said things went down. That Patrick pointed his gun at Carlton and pulled the trigger, but the gun jammed. Carlton then aimed his own gun at Patrick and killed him in self-defense. So how does the autopsy figure into this explanation?
Yeah, I was just about to ask that question. That doesn't seem like a wound you would sustain from the way that Carlton explained it. It seems like Carlton was either to the side or behind him.
Yeah, absolutely. So both the location and the number of bullet wounds seem to decry self-defense. Both shots entered towards the back of Patrick's head, not the front, which would be expected if Patrick was facing Carlton with the gun. In addition, the first bullet would have been enough to disable Patrick if Carlton was in fear for his life. The second shot was an execution kill. If this were purely self-defense, why would he have needed to shoot Patrick in the head twice? Toxicology tests on the body came back negative, although according to the autopsy report, the sample was unsuitable for a marijuana test. Now, normally in routine postmortem toxicology tests, samples are tested for alcohol, sedatives, benzodiazepines, cannabis, cocaine, narcotic analgesics such as codeine and methadone, and other stimulants such as amphetamine and methamphetamine. So, at the time of death, Patrick did not have any drugs in his system, although it should be noted that the marijuana test was inconclusive. At the same time that all this information was coming out regarding the murder investigation, an investigation of a different sort was occurring simultaneously. You see, as reporters covering the story began reaching out to all of these different individuals involved in Patrick's murder investigation, people began talking, and slowly a very bleak picture of the goings-on at the men's basketball program at Baylor University began to be framed on a national level. The first rumblings came out while Patrick was still missing, when Patrick's stepfather Brian expressed his frustration with the coaching staff, who had failed to alert him that Patrick hadn't been to class for a week.
Sure, yeah, that's pretty shocking.
Pretty understandable to be mad about that. After he realized the failings of the system, Brian decided to start contacting Patrick's friends at Baylor himself to try to understand how and why his son was missing.
That's a really interesting, like, good tactic. If somebody else isn't going to give you information, talk to his friends, like, see what they know.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he's a 20, 21-year-old kid. He's not telling his parents every single thing that's going on. So Brian and Valerie, Patrick's parents, are really trying to do their due diligence and talking to people and seeing what was going on at the time that Patrick went missing.
And he was very liked. He had a lot of friends, supposedly. So that's a lot of extra information that you could take advantage of.
Absolutely. He told the Waco Tribune Herald that's how he learned about the threats and the thefts that Patrick had been complaining about shortly before his disappearance, is because he actually went out and started talking to people. He also learned that Patrick had told friends that he had gone to Baylor coaching staff to report that he believed Harvey Thomas was threatening and stealing from him. Jessica, Patrick's girlfriend from the University of New Mexico, said that Patrick told her he had spoken to two assistant coaches on June 9th to discuss the threats, but felt that his worries had been ignored. She said he was irritated that coaches didn't seem to be taking the whole situation very seriously. According to Patrick's mom, Valerie, one of the assistant coaches told her that he'd instructed Patrick not to go to the police about the missing money and the vehicle break-in, that coaches would handle the issue internally.
Okay, this seems like they're trying to protect one of their other players who is also maybe allegedly involved in some of these alleged events and thefts and threats. So it seems like they're trying to shelter their players and deal with it and not get it outside of the program where it explodes.
I think that's probably a pretty good description of what's happening right now. They're really on damage control at this point. But according to the coaching staff at Baylor, no reports of these threats were ever made to them. Dave Bliss told the Star-Telegram, quote, "Members of my staff met and had frequent contact with Patrick in the days leading up to his disappearance. At no time did Patrick say anything about safety concerns or personal threats." So basically, the coaching staff came out and said, "We knew about these thefts, we knew about the vehicle break-in, but we didn't know it was Harvey. We didn't know it potentially involved another basketball player. We didn't know that they were afraid for their lives, et cetera, et cetera." So there's two different stories that are really coming out in the press right now.
Yeah, definitely two separate types of accounts and details and facts.
Oh yeah, and we get a lot of that this case.
Man, it smells like a smokescreen or a cover job.
By mid-July, other more serious allegations began to be made in the media regarding major breaches of NCAA regulations by the Baylor basketball program. Patrick's ex-girlfriend stated that a Baylor coach had once paid for her and Patrick's dinner at a restaurant. Another friend said Patrick told her that Baylor coaches had paid for the U-Haul Patrick rented when he moved from Albuquerque to Waco. Melissa, Carlton's estranged wife, said that Carlton would meet with Baylor coaches and come out with money, usually $50 or so. But Jessica, Patrick's girlfriend, went a step further to bring to light the serious charges of ethics violations by Baylor coaches. She reported herself for accepting money to pay for a cab ride from Waco to Dallas while she was in town visiting Patrick. The cab fare was $130 and paid for by Baylor coaches, she said. Now, as punishment, she would later be not allowed to play on the softball team for part of the following season. But that's how serious she was. She knew she was going to get in trouble, but she wanted this information out there.
Yeah, and I think based on this story and the details that we're hearing so far, that information is really important to get out if something bad and unethical and some sort of inside cover-up is happening with this case. And clearly, she cared for Patrick. So, wow, it's going to be interesting to see where this goes.
Yeah. Well, another player told his parents about drug and alcohol use by the Baylor basketball players. His mother even contacted the coaching staff to try to clue them in and talk to them about all of this drug use she was hearing from her son. But she said her calls were never returned. Melissa said that she was also aware of drug and alcohol use by Carlton and other basketball players on the team. So it was like everyone had a little piece of the puzzle, at least an example of a rumor they heard or something they themselves observed. But no one had the full story of the magnitude of the accusations until all of this was unfolding in the media. And these allegations were just the beginning. Far more nefarious accusations began to be leveled at the Baylor athletic program. For example, Jessica told Brian that she thought the coaches had helped buy Patrick his Chevy Tahoe, spending between $1,200 and $1,800 for a down payment for the vehicle. Brian had previously thought Patrick's dad had helped him get the vehicle.
Yeah, this sounds like a similar story in college sports of handing out money, assisting people when you shouldn't, buying luxury items like cars or trucks or clothes. And a lot of programs have gotten in trouble for this in the past and still do. But it's an advantage if you're a very lucrative big university that has coffers to sneak some money under the table to attract some athletes to your program to better your program.
Exactly.
And that's where the unethical part comes in.
It becomes an unfair advantage to programs that can afford to shower people with presents and money and et cetera, et cetera. So that's really where we're getting down to the problem here is what they're doing is just completely far and away against NCAA regulations. You are not allowed to do any of these things.
Yeah, definitely.
And some of these obviously are more serious charges than others. And while it was initially reported that Patrick had received a scholarship to join Baylor, Patrick's parents confirmed that he, in fact, had not. Last episode, we talked briefly about how the Baylor program was focused on recruiting new players for the upcoming 2002-2003 season. Five players were offered scholarships and signed to Baylor in this way. However, some of these newest recruits were not doing so great academically, and worry set in that they would not be able to maintain their GPA to qualify to play. So that's when Dave Bliss decided to recruit two more players, one of whom we will call Student Athlete 1, the other being Patrick Dennehy. This was almost insurance. If not all these players are going to qualify, then we can offer the scholarship to Patrick or this other guy instead, right?
Okay.
However, all five players ended up qualifying for their scholarships. That meant that Coach Bliss and the program had overextended itself, offering more scholarships than it could pay out. But Bliss didn't want to lose Patrick or the other player. So in order to keep them around, Dave Bliss decided to pay the two students' tuition himself while pretending that their expenses were being paid for by a grant.
Wow, that does not seem legal under NCAA regulations.
It's very, very wrong. It's very bad, yes. Baylor now had a very messy PR nightmare to regulate. On June 25th, the same day Patrick's body was discovered, Baylor announced that it would be forming a committee to investigate the allegations of rules violations and improper tuition payments. The committee, formed by two Baylor law professors and an outside attorney named Kirk Watson, who was, interesting side note here, a former mayor of Austin.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. These three were tasked with getting down to the bottom of the charges. On July 28th, head coach Dave Bliss called a news conference to deny the allegations that he or his staff had violated NCAA rules. He said, quote, "We have followed the rules, however difficult they may be, for 30 years.
And this is before any of the results from the investigation come out.
This is just the announcement about the creation of the committee to investigate these rumors.
Well, we'll see, Mr. Bliss.
Mm-hmm. In the midst of the accusations against Baylor and the confusion over Carlton's confession to murder, Patrick Dennehy's funeral service was held in San Jose, California on August 7th, 2003. MC Hammer, who is apparently a minister now, read Patrick's favorite psalm at the service.
Wow. I did not expect MC Hammer to show up in this story.
Neither did I. I thought that was a strange little detail. The Sacramento Kings, Patrick's favorite NBA basketball team, made him an honorary member and sent a jersey with his name on it to be displayed at the service.
Oh, man, that is a really touching tribute.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure it was really heartfelt, especially from the family.
Yeah.
In attendance at the memorial service was Robert Sloan, the president of Baylor, Tom Stanton, Baylor's athletic director, and of course, Coach Dave Bliss, as well as other Baylor officials. And even though one might think Patrick's family might have some resentment towards Baylor at this time, Patrick's stepfather told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, quote, "I know Baylor has been getting a lot of bad press. As far as Patrick's mom and I are concerned, we welcome Baylor to Patrick's celebration and we are honored to have them." In fact, Brian and Valerie shook the hands of Dave Bliss and the others at Patrick's memorial. It must have been quite a shock then when the very next day after Patrick's funeral, Baylor announced another press conference. This time, Baylor President Robert Sloan announced that the investigatory committee had already discovered evidence that the Baylor coaching staff, with Dave Bliss's knowledge and approval, had paid the tuition and expenses of at least two different Baylor basketball players. Immediately following the announcement, Coach Dave Bliss and Athletic Director Tom Stanton both resigned.
You hear that sound, Aaron?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's the sound of the other shoe dropping.
Oh, we're not even there yet.
Oh, man.
I understand you think this is crazy as this gets. Oh, no, there's more.
Oh, boy. Okay, there's a lot of shoes in this story, apparently.
We're talking about a whole shoe store.
Oh, gosh, and the whole shelf got knocked over.
Mm-hmm. About a week after the press conference where it was announced that the investigatory committee found evidence of improper payments made by the Baylor basketball program, things got even worse for former Baylor head coach Dave Bliss. In what would become the most disturbing news yet out of Baylor, on August 15th, reporter Danny Robbins published a piece for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram that included transcripts of secret conversations between Coach Dave Bliss and other assistant coaches and student players regarding the committee's investigation.
Ooh, I love a released secret conversation.
Oh, I really do. You see, someone on the Baylor coaching staff with deep knowledge of what was going on behind the scenes decided to secretly tape Coach Bliss. That man was assistant coach Abar Rouse. Abar was a Baylor graduate, graduating in 1996, and getting a basketball coaching gig at his alma mater was his dream come true. He was elated. He was only 28, and he's on this great career path. But unfortunately for Abar, he was hired at Baylor on June 1st, 2003, less than 2 weeks before Patrick went missing. So Abar joined a program that was already in complete disarray. There was a lot going on there besides just basketball.
Wow, he just went right into the fire, didn't he?
Yep.
And it sounds like he really had a passion for the university, for the athletes. He seemed like he would be the perfect hire, except for he's going into a very corrupt program in complete disarray.
Yeah, that's right. According to Abar, the decision to secretly record Dave Bliss came out of a mounting concern that he was asking staff and players to lie to the investigatory committee to cover up NCAA infractions. Specifically, Bliss said that about $7,000 of Patrick's tuition was unaccounted for, meaning that it had been paid, but no one knew who had paid it, and they needed a way to explain where that money came from. Bliss's plan was as simple as it was inelegant. He wanted players to suggest that Patrick Dennehy had paid the $7,000 of his tuition himself by selling drugs.
Wow. Okay, so he's getting other players to make horrible accusations, illegal activities in these accusations about Patrick to cover up his own unethical actions. Is that what you're saying?
Let's get into it. When Abar voiced his displeasure at this idea, because it's horrific,
He
said that a copy of his employment contract mysteriously landed on his desk, and someone had highlighted the section that discussed how Dave Bliss had the power to hire and fire his staff.
Well, that's a threat.
Afraid that if he continued to speak up, he'd be fired, but with no idea what else to do, Abar went hard. He hid a small microcassette recorder under his shirt, and for 3 days, from July 30th to August 1st, Abar covertly taped conversations he had with Coach Bliss. In those 3 days of recordings, Abar Rouse caught Coach Bliss attempting to manipulate three different student players into creating false narratives in order to throw off suspicion that the Baylor basketball coaching staff had done anything wrong. In the taped meetings with the other players, Bliss explained further. He told them that it sure would be helpful to him and to Baylor if they'd tell a story or two about Patrick doing and selling drugs. In fact, he got into some details, suggesting that, hey, maybe they saw Patrick at a party bring out a tray with all sorts of illicit drugs. Bliss called it, quote, wild shit, and how Patrick carried around a roll of $50 to $60, $100 bills. He said that telling these stories to the investigatory committee would, quote, save Baylor. A couple of the players he was speaking to on the tapes mentioned that they had smoked weed with Patrick and or Carlton, and they were afraid they'd get into trouble. Coach Bliss told the player not to worry. Patrick couldn't deny or confirm any of their accounts, after all, because he was dead.
This is so screwed up.
It's awful. Now, for the most part, it's clear that Bliss was instructing these players to tell these falsehoods to the Baylor Investigatory Committee. But at one point, he did tell one of the players that he could first relay all of this information to the sheriff's department as, quote, practice. He also offered to provide tape recorders so the players could practice memorizing and reciting their stories about Patrick. So it indeed seems as though he is also suggesting that they lie to police. Because really, think about it. He needs to present a united front on this. There's an investigatory committee at Baylor looking at NCAA infractions, and then there's a murder investigation.
Yeah.
So you need one simple story. Patrick was a druggie. He's a drug dealer. He's a messy person. And Baylor certainly was not at fault for anything that happened to him.
Dude, this is like some Game of Thrones Master of Spies kind of thing with like these layered lies on one unified front, but to multiple different organizations.
Sure. Yeah.
Dude, this guy is so corrupt.
In the tapes, Abar asked Bliss if he thought Harvey Thomas would agree with his plan. And Bliss told him that Harvey would be willing to lie for Baylor. Quote, Harvey will do anything. And the reason is because we did it for Harvey. That's why we're in this jam. We stuck up for Harvey. I said there were no threats, and all these people got ticked at me. So here's Bliss on tape admitting, seemingly, that coaches were aware of the troubles between Harvey and Carlton and Patrick and had lied about it.
And done nothing about it.
Yep. Now, as you can imagine, news of the secret recordings proving that the head coach of a college basketball team was working to slander the name of a recently murdered player under his care absolutely enraged Patrick's family.
Oh, I can imagine. It's one of the most salacious sports stories maybe ever. Of that decade or ever.
Yeah. Brian told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, quote, someone's going down because that's bullshit talking like that, especially trying to besmirch my son's name when he's dead. You know, that guy shook my hand at Patrick's memorial, and I thanked him for coming. He's just a two-faced, bald-ass liar.
Yeah, and I can only imagine the hurt and disrespect and anger that he would feel being in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is not only a major NCAA violation for trying to provide false information to an investigatory committee, but all of this is just so horrifically unethical. It's just so unethical and so disturbing. And it also seemed to confirm that coaches knew that players were smoking marijuana, that they lied when they said that they had never known about these issues with Patrick and Carlton and Harvey. You know, there's all of these things that are coming out in with these tapes.
Yeah. And, you know, I hope at this point of the story moving forward, I'm really hoping that anyone who was involved with this scandal, who knew about it and helped with the cover-up and the lies, never, ever is in a position where they can do this ever again.
Well, we'll talk about that at the end of the episode. You might not be super happy about what happens.
Oh, boy.
Well, speaking of Carlton, he had retained legal counsel in Maryland and was fighting extradition back to Texas. On August 27th, the McLennan County grand jury returned an indictment against Carlton for Patrick's murder. And days later, Texas Governor Rick Perry signed a governor's warrant to request his extradition for trial. Later in September, Maryland Governor Robert Ehrlich Jr. signed the extradition warrant. And although Carlton and his attorneys had spoken about fighting extradition, they decided not to appeal. By the end of October, Carlton Dotson was back in Texas to face his murder charge, which came with a maximum sentence of life in prison. He pled not guilty in a Waco courtroom on October 29th, 2003.
Yeah, that's interesting that they would have the hearing in Waco. So a lot of times defense attorneys will try and move a trial location to get a better jury pool.
I think they were talking about it. I know there was consideration put into doing a change of venue.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Two Texas defense lawyers were appointed for Carlton Dotson, Russell Hunt and Abel Reyna. People wondered, would Carlton's team's strategy be a claim of self-defense? Or would they choose an insanity defense based on Carlton's alleged past and present mental illness?
I'm wondering the exact same thing.
Well, Carlton's defense team announced that they would not be pursuing an insanity defense. But it was clear that Carlton was not mentally well and not stable enough to assist in his own defense. A psychiatrist hired by the defense team determined that Carlton Dotson was not competent to stand trial. A psychiatrist for the prosecution agreed, as did a third professional. Finally, in October of 2004, a year after Carlton had been brought back to Texas, a judge officially declared Carlton incompetent to stand trial, and he was moved into a maximum security mental health facility. After his stay and with proper medication, Carlton was declared fit for trial at the beginning of 2005, with his trial set to begin that summer. During that period, Carlton's Waco lawyers began seeking a plea deal with prosecutors, but a deal was never reached. But then, another shock. Carlton Dotson, out of nowhere, pled guilty to the murder of Patrick Dennehy on June 8th, 2005, just 5 days before his trial was set to begin.
Wow, that is a shock. I don't think anybody saw that coming.
No. There was no plea deal, no promises made, no leniency, nothing. Carlton just simply pled guilty.
Well, maybe now that he's in a better mental state, he has like a true understanding of his actions and what really happened, maybe, hopefully. I don't know.
It's possible for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe the guilt just caught up to him and he made the right decision.
Mm-hmm. The guilty plea was a real shock, and there was a bit of a mixed reaction to it. Baylor officials, of course, were thrilled because it meant that Baylor's name wouldn't be dragged through the mud again in a messy trial. Patrick's family, on the other hand, expressed mixed emotions. It was nice that everything was over now, but they were expecting to get answers during a trial. With Patrick pleading guilty, it meant no trial and maybe no hope for getting those answers. On June 15th, 2005, Carlton Dotson was sentenced to 35 years in prison. By pleading guilty, he waived his right to appeal, meaning he will have to serve half of his sentence before he will be eligible for parole. In 2006, Carlton attempted to request permission to appeal his sentence, but the request was denied. His first parole review is set for 2021, when Carlton will be 38 years old.
Wow, just next year.
Now, one of his defense attorneys, Russ Hunt, said that the defense in the trial would have brought up additional drug use by Patrick and Carlton, including the use of methamphetamine, specifically crystal meth, before the murder. They had been planning to argue that the drugs had increased Carlton's paranoia and made him believe Patrick was one of them, someone else out to get them. Remember, Carlton is describing these events, how he is paranoid that somebody's trying to kill him, out to get him, etc.
Yeah, he's also seeing demons and stuff. There's no telling what his perception of Patrick was during the time.
Mm-hmm. So this is not necessarily a self-defense strategy, nor is it really in an insanity defense. It's kind of both in a way. But I just like to point out again that no drugs were found in Patrick's system. Now, meth can be detected in urine up to 3 to 5 days after administration of the drug, or even up to a week in chronic users. So at the time of his death, Patrick did not have any of the drugs they test for routinely in his system, although, of course, the marijuana results were apparently inconclusive, but there was nothing to show that he was taking or using crystal meth.
Yeah, that makes me think that kind of excuse or defense strategy just really doesn't hold water.
Yeah. Well, we'll never know, obviously, because it didn't end up going to court. But it was an interesting little side piece that I saw when they were talking to the media about sort of this is the plan that we're going with. And I said, that's a very strange plan. I don't understand that at all.
No, they were probably just grasping for straws and in some sort of defense at the time.
Sure, perhaps. Well, in June of 2005, the NCAA Public Infractions Report addressing all the violations uncovered during the investigation at Baylor was released. Now, this is a 54-page document detailing every little infraction, even very minor things, but let's quickly discuss the major findings. The committee found that many of Baylor's student-athletes and prospects during the years 2001 to 2003 received, quote, impermissible extra benefits, including paid housing, meals, airline tickets, lodging, cash, tuition, fees, books, apparel, and all sorts of things from the university's program. Student athlete one received over $20,000 in these impermissible benefits, and Patrick Dennehy had received about $10,000 in benefits during the 2002 and 2003 academic year alone. Wow. And that's just what they could prove.
Yeah, that means that it's just the tip of the iceberg, probably.
Probably. The committee also found that Coach Bliss flew to student athlete one's home to pay a personal visit to his mother to help her formulate a story regarding how her son's tuition was paid And he provided her fake documents and financial records that she could use to assert that she had paid her son's tuition. In 2003, Coach Bliss also placed a phone call to Baylor's financial aid office in which he pretended to be student player one's father and asked for them to describe to him how tuition payments would be reflected in the student's account. So he was doing this because he had been paying them with money orders and cashier's checks, and he was wondering if that would be reflected in the account and could possibly lead back to him.
The amount of lies and corruption in this story just has me baffled and flabbergasted.
Agreed. The committee also found that in the fall of 2002, the Baylor basketball program opted to conduct drug tests on its players. Three players tested positive for marijuana, but the results of the tests were never reported to the institution, nothing ever came of the failed tests, and the players were never disciplined. Between the sanctions that Baylor placed on itself and the punishment doled out by the NCAA for the violations, the program was placed on a 5-year probation, and the team was allowed to play only in a limited capacity for 1 year. All the players on the Baylor men's basketball team were allowed the opportunity to transfer from Baylor to another program, and many ended up leaving the university in the wake of the scandal.
Sure. I mean, they have their futures to plan for, and they have to go somewhere with an active program where they can showcase their skills and hopefully become a professional basketball player. That's the ultimate goal for
sure.
These guys.
Yeah. The worst punishments were meted out to Dave Bliss and three other assistant coaches who were found to have acted with blatant and sweeping disregard of NCAA rules. All four men were placed on a show cause order, meaning that for the following decade, any NCAA program would not be allowed to hire them without justifying that decision before a committee. So it makes it very, very difficult to continue coaching for about a decade after these events happened. It's one of the most serious punishments that the NCAA can hand out a coach.
Yeah, because I imagine if you're a university, you really have to think about that when potentially trying to hire one of these guys. Is it worth the trouble to have to go through all these extra hurdles to get this person on your program who's probably corrupt?
Exactly. And you assume the responsibility over that person. So if they continue making mistakes, your program's going to be held liable for that because you made the decision to hire them. So this is a very serious disciplinary action.
Yeah, it sounds like it's almost a possible career ender.
Well, let's talk about that, Shay, because now let's kind of wrap everything up. Let's talk about some of the other key players and what happened to them after all of this.
Okay.
So let's start with Coach Bliss himself. Although law enforcement expressed interest, of course, in reviewing these tapes, specifically because it looked like he was trying to get players to lie to law enforcement.
Oh, it definitely sounded like that.
Mm-hmm. But no charges against Dave Bliss or any other coaches or students were ever brought up. Baylor was ruled not liable for Patrick's death in a lawsuit his father filed, and Coach Bliss settled a civil lawsuit with Patrick Dennehy's mother. During the 10 years after Bliss resigned from Baylor, he worked at various high schools, even becoming the dean of students, athletic director, and head coach for the boys' basketball team at Allen Academy in 2010. After Bliss's show cause penalty expired, Southwestern Christian University hired Dave Bliss to run its basketball program in 2016.
I can't believe any intelligent human being would ever put him in a position where he had control and access to their students.
Especially because during that 10 years after all this happened, he was basically working high schools.
Yeah.
People were hiring him to look after teenagers.
And it's not like this wasn't a huge story that was covered
everywhere
in the media. So you know who this guy is and what he's potentially capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yep.
What a weird thing to happen. I guess like these high schools must have been really desperate for a coach or something. I don't know how you would hire this guy.
Yeah. Well, in 2017, the Showtime documentary Disgraced aired. And it reinvigorated people's interest in the case.
Good.
Coach Dave Bliss agreed to be interviewed for the documentary, and he maintained that the stories he brought up in the tapes, the tray of crazy drugs, the roll of $100 bills, that they were all true stories that other players had told him about Patrick, and that he was just simply trying to use the truth to cover up the tuition payments and the other rules violations.
Yeah, okay.
He continues to avoid taking responsibility for anything that happened at Baylor, saying, quote, "I didn't do anything. I said bad things about the kid, but the parents also knew he was a druggie." He said this on the documentary.
God, so he's still dragging Patrick through the mud.
He is. He also referred to Patrick as the worst drug offender on the team. So he made all of these comments in this documentary, and apparently he believed he was saying them off the record, but he said them on camera. So they all, of course, were included in the documentary.
Yeah.
His comments were such a bad look that only a few days after the documentary aired, Dave Bliss resigned from his post at Southwestern Christian University. However, he was back at it rather quickly and was hired at a Christian high school in Las Vegas to be the boys' basketball coach and the athletic director. So somehow this man continues to be hired at athletic programs for children, even in the light of everything that he has said and done.
Well, it's got to be like any other job where it's high stakes and money's involved.
Oh, yeah.
You know, cheaters and people who get caught still somehow find a way to weasel their little hands back into the coffers.
And just to be clear, because, you know, Coach Bliss is still saying that Patrick Dennehy was this huge druggie, that he was a drug user and seller, and that, you know, he still maintains all of this. Throughout all of the rumors and allegations from Coach Bliss, from Carlton Dotson, by others, nothing was ever found to suggest that Patrick Dennehy was messing around with hard drugs, that he was a drug addict, or that he sold drugs. In fact, Waco police detective said in an interview for Disgraced that while a few student athletes said they'd occasionally seen Patrick smoke pot, not a single person that investigators spoke to said they had ever seen Patrick selling drugs.
Yeah, and also Patrick, you discussed in part one, had a completely clean record. He wasn't known for this kind of activity.
No, not at all.
Yeah, he doesn't fit the bill for someone who's a drug dealer carrying out this tray of crazy stuff.
Wild
shit, as Dave Bliss would put it. Yeah.
So that's what happened to Dave Bliss. Let's talk a little bit about what happened to Abar Rouse.
Oh, this is the whistleblower, right?
It is. Dave Bliss's career moves after everything came out are a far cry from the fallout suffered by Abar Rouse. Even though one could argue that Abar did the right thing, perhaps was the best example on the Baylor coaching staff for being honest and setting the right example, he basically was never able to coach again. No one would hire him. He was seen as a pariah, someone who broke the code of trust. As of 2017, Abar is working as a teacher in a federal prison because he just cannot get a coaching job anywhere.
And you know, this seems to happen a lot of times when there's a whistleblower. It always seems to come back on the whistleblower. And that's why we now are supposed to have whistleblower legislation to protect these people, because they're trying to do the right thing. And Dave Bliss gets to go on about his happy, merry life teaching and coaching. But the person who's responsible for showing the corruption in this case and coming forward with the truth is the one that gets the black badge of dishonor.
Yeah, it's incredibly illogical and ironic how that happens.
I think something similar happened in the Joe Paterno case.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. Finally, let's just wrap up things with Harvey Thomas, because obviously he is a very mysterious figure in this case. What he did or did not do is up for speculation. He still maintains that he never threatened Patrick or Carlton, and that he had nothing to do with Patrick's murder. He says that his name being involved in Patrick's murder investigation basically ruined his basketball career. He did declare for the NBA draft in 2004, but he went unsigned.
There was never any real truth or any facts that came out in the case to show that he had done anything wrong.
There really wasn't anything. No, you're right.
Interesting.
So, in conclusion, what happened here at Baylor? And why was it murder? Did Patrick get ensnared in a web of Carlton's paranoid delusions due to untreated mental illness? That's what some people think.
It really makes me wonder if any of those allegations against Harvey were ever real, and if it wasn't just all inside Carlton's head, and Patrick, being his best friend, was trying to be supportive and believed him.
You know, it's totally possible. The only thing that makes me think that something happened, even if it was something very, very minor, maybe words said, you know, a little tiff that happened between the three of them, but was specifically with that Dave Bliss said, I said there were no threats. And, you know, so we stood up for him and had his back. Because he mentioned that in the tapes, it makes me think that something happened, but how serious it was certainly are questions that we just don't have the answers to.
Yeah, there is no truth to a liar's statements, you know? So if a liar and someone who's corrupt is actively trying to cover something up tells you something, you probably think that the exact opposite is true.
Yeah, so I mean, who knows, really? Finally, why did Carlton just plead guilty instead of trying his luck at trial? Well, in Disgraced, the makers suggest that in one final crown of corruption and injustice, Carlton's own lawyers, both Baylor grads themselves, helped to push the case through the system and to get Carlton to plead guilty, perhaps against his own best interest.
What a tidbit.
Mm-hmm. In the documentary, John Segrest, district attorney at the time, said that Carlton's defense attorneys told him, quote, "This is making Baylor look bad. Can't we just get over it?"
Man, this is a good old boy system at its worst.
Ooh, it's awful. So the end result is a man who may have been seriously mentally ill at the time of Patrick's murder, and perhaps it affected his judgment and competence, yet he was maybe pushed into pleading guilty, and he's now in prison with no options for appeal because of that guilty plea. So that's just something to kind of take into consideration. Yeah. I would highly recommend watching Disgraced if you're still interested in the story. It's a fascinating case. It's absolutely tragic. And of course, it is not the only scandal that Baylor is known for.
That is correct. You know, when you first brought up to me that you were thinking of covering a Baylor case, my mind immediately jumped to the 2011 to 2015 time period where Baylor had the horrific rape crisis. It was actually termed the Baylor rape crisis because there were like 125 potential victims in 4 years. And the university took a very interestingly parallel and similar track record to their behavior in the past and really tried to do a cover-up, a smear job, and protect their football players, where I believe like 19 of their football players were accused of these horrific rapes. So, I mean, it's just kind of some foreshadowing of things to come in Baylor's track record of behaving really poorly as a university and an athletic program and when criminal actions happen.
Yeah. And covering up really, really illegal, unethical, bad behavior.
Yeah, it's not a good look.
No, it is not.
And poor Patrick, I mean, he seemed like a really good kid and just got swept up in all this. And I feel so bad for his family and all of his friends who cared about him. Because he did seem like a good kid and a great guy and very well liked and had a very high level of potential. And it's just so tragic that he never got to play at the level that he probably could have played at.
Yeah, you can really tell how loved he was by his family and his friends. Remember, you know, all of this is his family and friends coming out and speaking to the media and saying, "We know this, we know that." They really just tried so hard to move the case forward and to get justice for Patrick. So,
And definitely after you see someone you cared about who you knew was a good person and you see their name getting tarnished the way it was and being, like we said before, drug through the mud. I mean, I cannot believe the destruction of character that employees of that university participated in.
I can't believe anybody would hire Coach Dave Bliss after that. Sorry. Seriously. Wow. I would not want him to be around my child. I will tell you that.
I wouldn't want him to work at a daycare.
Mm-mm. He can make me a sub sandwich. That's about it.
Man, I don't know if I want him working at Subway. That might be giving him too much power.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe he could be a professional toilet bowl cleaner.
All right, I'm fine with that. For $5 an hour.
Well, I gotta say, you did an epic job of researching this case. I know people won't get to see your full source list that you had.
It'll be posted on the website.
Oh, that's true. I guess you will see it. So once it is posted to the website, you can go and look at the myriad and copious amounts of sources that Aaron went through for this case. You really did a bang up job and you've spent the better part of 4 weeks really preparing this case. So thanks so much for bringing that to us. It was a very tragic story, but very fascinating. And I think these crimes and sports cases add another layer to true crime, and it's happened in our own backyard.
Yeah. That's right. It's a really sad story. So I think we're all ready for a good news story.
Well, I got one for you, and I'm excited to tell it to you right after this.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo, and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This week's good news segment originates from our own backyard here in North Texas, and it's from Dallas, in fact. The source for this good news comes from the Oak Cliff Advocate, and it's an article just from last week written by Rachel Stone. And this good news segment is really made possible because of two really amazing Oak Cliff women. These women are Peggy Larney and Jody Voice Yellowfish, and they have been working really, really hard for years to accomplish something amazing for the state of Texas and its indigenous communities. These two women's tireless efforts have resulted in the creation of Texas American Indian Heritage Day. Almost 7 years ago, Peggy Larney, the founder of Indian Citizens Against Racial Exploitation, originated a bill to create Texas American Indian Heritage Day. And this all got started in the Texas House of Representatives. She introduced a bill, it was House Bill 174, and it called for a day to recognize the historic, cultural, and social contributions of American Indians throughout the state of Texas. A friend and colleague of Peggy's, Jody Voice Yellowfish, helped to write this bill in 2013, and House Bill 174 was quickly signed into law by then-Governor Rick Perry. And that was back on Friday, May 10th, 2013. This bill designated the last Friday of each September as Texas American Indian Heritage Day. Since the passing of this bill, Jody has moved on to focus her efforts on the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Initiative. And she focuses a lot of her work on Texas and North Texas specifically, but she also works to focus on cases from Oklahoma all the way up into Canada. And she's just an amazing person. I've actually spoken to Jody a few times about cases from the DFW area, and she's looking to work with podcasts to get the message out to help bring some spotlights and added coverage to these missing and murdered Indigenous women from the area. So in this article, Jody actually spoke about the importance of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Initiative, and she said, quote, "Our country was colonized with violence, and it's never really stopped. We still have these historical traumas, but being in a huge city like Dallas and sometimes not having the resources is a struggle that we continue to deal with. We've really opened a lot of doors and found resources to help missing and murdered Indigenous women families to fill in the gap. It's sad and it's very traumatizing work for groups like ours, but there are small victories every time we help a family." But regarding the Texas American Indigenous Heritage Day, Jody spoke with the Oak Cliff Advocate, and she also said that there was a need to celebrate, quote, "the culture, but also to uplift contemporary victories and work." She went on to say, quote, "It's not just a celebration of culture and heritage. We're often relegated to this very romanticized past. We can't just talk about our struggles today and what our communities are fighting for. We also have to re-educate and explain our history to people, and people want to know about the sad struggle of our history and show the regalia and hear the songs, but the contemporary struggles and victories are often overlooked. It's something people don't realize. We're not just what our culture has been in the past, we're an ever-evolving group of people still here today." Jody and several other American Indian community members have since celebrated this occasion the last week of September, and they've also started celebrating into October to really show the importance of representing our Native American heritage here in the Lone Star State. And actually, on Monday, the 12th at 2 p.m. Central Time, they hosted a celebration for Texas American Indian Heritage, and it's the 8th annual celebration. And by all accounts, it looked like a really fascinating talk about fostering Indigenous communities through art and activism. And if you want to hear more about that or check out some of their lectures and talks and other activities and celebrations that they do, You can visit their website over at AmericanIndianHeritageDayInTexas.com. So yeah, I just think it's like a really amazing initiative. Personally, I went through high school and lower education without ever really learning about Texas's Native American culture and history and past. And it's really a tragedy. And I think it's something that we need to really focus on moving forward, to know where we as Texans come from, no matter what creed, culture, or ethnicity you are.
That sounds awesome. It sounds like a really great way to celebrate the diversity in Texas and learn more about the people right in our neighborhood. So it's really a great cause, and I'm interested in learning more about it.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Well, welcome back to the after show. Thanks for joining us here. This is where we unbutton our top button, let our hair down, relax a little, and we give some thanks to some wonderful patrons, and that's about it.
Yeah. All you patrons out there know that I'm giving you thanks with my top button open right now.
It's very sexy. And remember, you can always find us on Twitter at ACNC Podcast, on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle. You can find our Facebook page at All Crime No Cattle and our Facebook group, which is the ACNC Posse Discussion Group. You can also send us an email at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com.
That is correct. And if you want to support the show and help us out in any way, if you like what you're listening to, go over to Patreon. Just search All Crime No Cattle. We'll pop right up. There's lots of ways to support the show and added benefits and perks. And speaking of which, we need to get to talking about some of our awesome Texas Rangers who are producers for every episode of this show. They include the amazing Lisa Layton, who has been here with us since the beginning, Serial Killer Sweets, Kate Williams, Don Maloney, Mickey V, Carol Lubahusen, Nigel, Emma Jordan, Jessica Dommel, Joanne Cooley, Becky Gildersleeve, Dawn N. Tanner, Haley Wilson, Noelle Richards, Heather Burke, Lee Daugherty, Selena Camarillo Vasquez, Brandy Gerner, and Jessica Layfield. Thank you so much, guys. We really appreciate it. You make the show possible, and we can't thank you guys enough. And we will be back with a new episode. So yeah, we'll be coming right back at you guys, hopefully really soon, with a brand new episode. We've got a bunch of irons in the fire. We're also planning our spooky Halloween episode, and we got some stuff coming up for you patrons too. So everybody stick around. We'll have more for you guys soon, but for now, always remember that crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Goodbye.
Oh, the dulcet tones of Aaron.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys.